The song seems particularly well-suited for Wisconsin, with its heady history of taverns and breweries. What role have the state's watering holes played in the lives of its citizens? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What effects did temperance and prohibition have on life in Wisconsin? And what attitudes do taverns reveal about gender and ethnicity and morality? Finding the answers will require a little bit of a field trip to some of the state's historic bars and breweries, a virtual one, I guess you could say, and our guides for it are going to be Jim Drager and Mark Speltz, authors of Bottoms Up, published in 2012 by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
As you worked on this book, Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries, I'm guessing you might have gotten a little bit of ribbing about the kind of research and quotes that goes into writing a book about bars and breweries. Have you found that it's hard to come across as a serious historian, as you obviously both are, but have you taken some ribbing?
We took a great deal of ribbing, and probably the number one question that I got was, can I come along on the research trips? And my response was always, we need more designated drinkers. Because, you know, if you're doing serious research, there's not a lot of time for drinking. And so we did have one trip where we brought a designated drinker along with us, and it was really pretty much fun. Mm-hmm.
And what motivated you to undertake this project? Of, you know, what sort of led you to embark on a kind of a selection of 70 bars?
Well, I think my history with bars goes back pretty far in time. I've had a fondness for bars since I was a kid growing up in Wisconsin and going to taverns with my dad. But it was really when I became college-aged and started traveling around with my friends, and we realized that we liked these old-timer bars, if we called them, better than the other bars. And so I've been an aficionado of those kind of places that seem to be caught in time for over 30 years now. And have always been kind of kicking around ideas about taverns in my head long before we were ever approached to do this book.
Is there a difference between a tavern and a bar?
No, really. Those two terms are pretty much synonymous. There's certainly a difference between a tavern and a saloon, but bar and tavern are kind of generic.
Mark, what about you and your reasons for becoming part of this?
Well, research? This project kind of came right on the heels of our earlier book called Filler Up, The Glory Days of Wisconsin's Historic Gas Stations. And we had a lot of time together, and we would be in small towns and looking at these gas stations and doing book events. And then the Wisconsin Historical Society Press came to us and said, let's look at this bars and taverns and breweries in the same way, this sort of half travel book, half social history. And we began to get work on it quite seriously.
How did you decide on the number of institutions to visit?
Well, we visited far more than that fit in the book. We visited somewhere around 350 taverns we spent some time in.
And how long did that take?
About a year and a half, 2 years maybe, something like that. Yeah. We put in a lot of miles. Our record day, we saw 27 taverns in one day.
And talking about the research before, it was a lot of fun. But we would get home and probably wouldn't talk for about 3 to 4 days because we had been in a car the whole weekend. Yeah. Our behinds were a little sore, not from bar stools or from falling off of them or slipping on the wet floor, but from riding in the front seats and navigating.
You must have found quite a spectrum of places then. I mean, you know, if we talk about them being all bars and taverns, and yet they vary so much. I mean, you already mentioned it, kind of a class distinction almost with some.
Yeah, that's what we tried to capture in the book, is the whole spectrum of the tavern experience in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin is a tavern state. It's really a very distinctive feature of our culture that we have so many taverns. And so we want to be able to capture that whole range and show people that, You know, they may have their own favorite watering hole, but this particular place fits into a broader spectrum, and each of these bars has a place in time that relates to what people valued and believed at that particular moment. So we deliberately picked a very wide and broad spectrum of taverns.
Well, let's start with territorial taverns, because you do start in your book talking about some of the taverns that were in Wisconsin before it was officially Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, how far back do you go to start seeing this phenomenon?
Well, the earliest records date back to the territorial days of Wisconsin. I'm sure that there were taverns before that during the French fur trade days. It's hard to imagine those fur traders didn't have taverns somewhere, but the first written records date back to that territorial period. And the first known tavern was established by a guy whose name was Arndt, who was a from Green Bay, and got the first tavern license in the days when Wisconsin was still part of the Michigan Territory. And he was a leading Wisconsin player. He was active in the Wisconsin Constitution and was a major political figure of the moment.
Any architectural features that we know about these early territorial taverns and how they were set up? Or
nothing's really captured from that early of a period, but the earliest taverns were really stagecoach stops. You know, they were places that offered lodging as well as drink. In the territorial laws, it was required that every tavern provide at least two sleeping beds and provender of hay, so that because they were really for people who were traveling. And so it's most likely that it looked much like the stagecoach stops that that still survive today, like the old Wade House.
Then when the railroads came in, it was a reflection of that mode of transportation, I suppose.
That's right.
Now, you mentioned that there's a difference between a tavern and a saloon. So what do you have to get to be a saloon?
Well, the saloons are the pre-Prohibition version of the tavern. When Prohibition was passed, they actually banned the use of the word saloon to refer to any tavern up until 1976. And in 76, it was finally removed.
Of the 70 bars that you selected for inclusion in your book, what's the oldest one?
Well, the oldest one in here, I believe, is Wade House, as Jim mentioned, in Greenbush, Wisconsin, which is a state historic site. And that includes the bar room where the proprietors of the house would have served drinks to the travelers and to the local farmers, and it served as a community gathering place. The next oldest one is probably, oddly, a temperance house, which okay. is in southeastern Wisconsin. And the temperance advocates said that we need places that are sober. So travelers who do not want to be sleeping next to someone drunk or snoring or whatever the case may be will have a temperate place to stop. And there they did pop up. We have this wonderful example that we include in the book, the Israel Stowell Temperance House in Delavan, Wisconsin, which is currently in the process of being saved from demolition, and its future is unknown, but it may be preserved. But they quickly realized that there weren't enough sober travelers and there wasn't enough business. So within about 5 years, this temperance house became a tavern. And what makes it even a little more fun of a story to tell in the book is Delavan was founded on temperance. It was written into the deeds that you could not sell alcohol and liquor in that community. So somehow they skirted it. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of the fun alcohol-related and temperance-related stories from the earliest days.
Wisconsin did have a strong temperance history. I mean, John mm-hmm. Olin, who is a very familiar name at the UW, for example, ran for the governorship on the temperance ticket in the 1870s.
Sure, sure. You see that tension between people who believe that being allowed to drink alcohol is part of living the good life, and the people who want to see everyone abstaining from liquor. That tension goes back and forth all the way through the history of Wisconsin from the very earliest days up to today. So, you know, the temperance movement of the 1880s is not a lot different than Mothers Against Drunk Driving today.
And if you look at why Wisconsin has such a strong history of breweries and bars and drinking in general, do you think it's largely the German immigrants that brought that tradition over, or what other factors put Wisconsin sort of on the map for alcohol?
Certainly, that was a big part of it. I think Wisconsin is a tavern state today because it had so many breweries. Wisconsin, you know, every small town in Wisconsin had a brewery at one point.
But
its life.
Why did it have all those?
Well,
breweries?
It had a lot of breweries because it had. It was easy to brew in Wisconsin because we had access to – we had great farmlands for growing the grains and hops. We had pure water. We had a very easy supply of ice here, which is important to be able to cool and preserve your beer. And if you're making lager beer, you have to use the ice to maintain the temperature at the right temperature. So all of those things made it a place where brewing was more common. But we also had a large German ethnic population as well, which meant that we had a lot of drinkers,
maybe,
as well as the Poles and the Irish.
Maybe they came here because they knew it would be great ground for brewing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You include in your book a quote by a prohibitionist, John Strang, who said, "The worst of all our German enemies and the most treacherous, the most menacing are Pabst, Schlitz, Blatzt, and Miller."
Yeah, that was a big part of the propaganda to be able to pass prohibition, was to demonize the Germans who were the kingpins of the Wisconsin brewing industry.
And this, of course, would have been right at the time of and immediately after World War I.
Yes, exactly. So it comes right out of that anti-German sentiment of World War I.
What are some of the earliest companies? I mean, that was mentioning some right there. What are some of the earliest companies that start making money from making beer and other kinds of alcohol?
Well, you mean brewing companies?
Yes.
One of the earliest that we featured in the book that's still brewing today is in Stevens Point with the Point Brewery, and I don't recall its earliest name, but it was about 1857. And they were one of the earliest, but they were really not unique. They were just a small brewery, and there were hundreds of them around Wisconsin, you know, from the 1840s, 50s, and 60s. And what begins to change in the 1870s is the fact that these companies are growing bigger. They are able to, you know, the biggest change then will be pasteurization. When beer can be pasteurized, you can ship it further. They can just expand their reach and market into the small communities. These other small communities, they can brew locally, but once those better-known brands coming out of Milwaukee get into their communities, if they lose an account, if they lose a bar account, they kind of start to dry up. Their businesses go away. Another one being the Great Chicago Fire in 1871 really allowed Milwaukee's companies and some of the breweries in Watertown in southeastern Wisconsin to ship beer there. And it begins this larger reputation that we then know today.
Are they sending beer by the barrel, by the bottle?
By the barrel in the early days, because bottles are hand-produced products. They're either made out of stoneware or out of glass, and they're all hand-blown. Then they had to be hand-filled. They had to be hand-corked. And so it was very labor-intensive to produce beer in bottles. So in the early days, they mostly shipped beer by keg. It wasn't until the early 20th century, really, that bottled beer becomes a commodity. But by the 1870s, breweries like Pabst are shipping beer nationwide. In the 1870s, Pabst shipped a shipment of beer all the way to Australia.
Wow.
They shipped a shipment there. They opened it, tried it, pronounced it to be good, and they shipped half of it back to Milwaukee, and then they opened it on the other end when it returned from the voyage and again pronounced it to be good. But, you know,
that's a good PR.
Who knows how good that was when it came back to Milwaukee. It was great PR.
What are some of the terms that got developed. I noticed one that was new to me was growler boys. Can you explain what that is? And some of the other kinds of terms that developed along this whole industry.
In the days before bottles, if you were going to take takeout from a bar, and bars sold in the 19th century, about 90% of all beer was sold by taverns. So if you wanted to get takeout beer, you had a galvanized pail that you'd bring into the bar, and the bartender would fill it up with beer, and then you'd take your pail of beer home, and they called those growlers. And if you go to brew pubs today, they sell jugs of beer that they call growlers, and that's where that name comes from. And so it wasn't unusual at all to send your kids to the tavern at the end of the day to pick up a growler of beer for you for the, for your evening after supper. And they, in the factories, they had, they employed kids to make beer runs for the factory workers. At lunchtime, if you want a pail of beer with your lunch, you'd put the growler boy would put the pail on a stick and hoist the stick over his shoulder and go down to the nearest bar and, fill all the pails and bring them all back. And it was kind of like being a newspaper boy.
Was there a drinking age in Wisconsin early on?
No, there wasn't a drinking age. And the one thing we couldn't really nail down is exactly when they stopped serving minors, but it's sometime in the late 19th century. It's really unclear when that date happens. And even after that happens, it's really difficult for them to figure out who is a minor, because nobody has driver's licenses or IDs to be able to prove how old they are. And so the best system they could come up with was were these things they called pledge books. And if someone came in and they looked like they were possibly a minor, you had them sign a pledge book saying that they were old enough to drink.
Honor system.
for
bar IDs.
Yeah, there was a great article in a La Crosse newspaper about the tavern owners getting together and requesting that the district attorney start prosecuting some of these teenagers who were lying in the pledge books, because they wanted to take the heat off of them from the temperance movement for serving minors.
Well, now, how would a place like University of Wisconsin figure into an arrangement like that, where you have hundreds of, 18, 19-year-olds, 17-year-olds in some cases, mm-hmm. trying to get from one end of State Street to the other and stay sober?
Yeah.
I gather it was a little like running a gauntlet.
Yeah, well, the university had a big struggle with the city of Madison over taverns, and they finally came to a truce when they decided that they would take a half-mile radius from the state capitol and draw a circle, and no taverns could be built outside of that half-mile radius in the vicinity of the university. And interestingly enough, right at the edge of the half-mile radius, but within it, was the Houseman Brewing Company, one of the big brewers of Madison. So they drew that line very carefully. So the lower end of State Street towards the campus traditionally didn't have any taverns at all.
Well, that's changed today. We're going to look more at bars and breweries in Wisconsin and the history that surrounds that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, Jim Drager and Mark Speltz, who are the authors of Bottoms Up. It's a history and a survey of Wisconsin's bars, taverns, and breweries. The question has arisen about the whole beer brewing process. Is it always supposed to be carbonated?
Well, the carbonization is a natural process of brewing, and as the as the beer is being aged, it's releasing carbon dioxide, which naturally carbonates the beer. If you buy a craft beer today, sometimes you'll see a beer that says bottle conditioned on the bottle, and that means it's carbonated in the bottle. And, today the major brewers control carbonation very carefully, and they inject carbon dioxide into the beer in order to give it just the right amount of carbonization. But it was a natural process. And once pasteurization comes in, it allows them to control that more carefully, because when you pasteurize the beer by heating it up to a high temperature, you kill all of the bacteria in the beer that would continue to be active. One of the things that spoils beer over time is bacteria continuing to work. So once you pasteurize it, it kills that process. It brings it to a halt. So the beer is stable over a longer point of time. And that means the beer has a longer shelf life, and you can ship your beer a lot farther.
Well, some beers do keep better than others, though, right? And I mean, it's a deliberate move on their part to avoid putting in preservatives.
Yes, definitely. And in the 19th century, the beer that kept the longest were lager beers. And that's why lager beers became such a huge thing in America. It was really the shelf life of lager beer as opposed to ales and porters and stouts, which had much shorter shelf lives. So, you know, today there's this whole culture of the dominant beers in America, the Buds and Millers, are lager beers that really extend their roots back to the point at which pasteurization makes a difference, and beers can sit on a shelf or be transported a lot longer or a lot farther.
You mentioned ice harvesting in the book. Can you explain what that is, how that fits into the story?
Well, the availability of ice plays a big part, and it does date back as long as you can imagine, but also to the lagering. Lagering caves are dug into the hillsides and cooled with the ice, you know, gathered by the breweries or delivered from a nearby lake. And it's used to cool and age the beer that was becoming more and more popular throughout Wisconsin. And if they didn't have that, well, they wouldn't have had cold beer and would have went bad. Mm-hmm. And this is really important, you know, right up until about 1900, but a little earlier on, you know, mechanical ice-making equipment is making big changes, and mm-hmm. the bigger breweries, which can afford it, will adopt it right away. And we see this a lot in Wisconsin with the large breweries really at the center of the industry and the technical innovations mm-hmm. being applied. And there are a couple places where we talk about that in the book.
Now, lager beers use a different yeast, type of yeast, than ale, stouts, and porters do. And that yeast had to be kept at a consistent 50-degree temperature in order for it to be able to work properly. So they maintain their temperature control in these caves by bringing in ice or taking ice out until they get to the point where they have mechanical refrigeration and they can really control the temperature carefully.
What are people making beer out of originally, or if we go back to the 19th century? Today we have, you know, bajillion kind, you know, blackberry beer and wheat beer and all this other variety. Was it hops originally?
Yeah, it's traditional beer is barley and hops, barley malts and hops. Sometimes they'd use a little corn in it. They still use corn in brewing today, but that's a much bigger thing. It's a much larger ingredient, and say Miller or Bud, those kinds of beers use a lot more corn.
Where did this burgeoning of variety kick in?
The burgeoning of variety really is a result of the legalization of home brewing, which we have Jimmy Carter to thank. It was President Carter in 1976 that legalized home brewing. Well, Billy Beer.
Yeah, well, that's true. His brother did have that label, yes.
Once they legalized home brewing, there were scores of people who were brewing in their basements and their garages and their kitchens who just started playing around with beer and trying to resurrect these old beer styles and beer recipes. And then some people were just not content with that, and they just would try whatever was in the kitchen. And, you know, today we have, as a result of that, we have very creative brewing with a lot of unusual ingredients just by people who are willing to take a chance that something drinkable might come out of it.
And so what would be the advantage of buying a relatively expensive, you know, Irish or Danish or German beer over getting the Wisconsin brand? I mean, is there a mystique there, or is there really a quantifiable difference?
The bottle has some different art on it, maybe. You know, my son described me as a beer enthusiast, which I thought was a nice compliment. But I think that Wisconsin beers are among the best beers in the world right now. And so the likelihood of buying a foreign beer that's going to be as good as any beer that you can buy in Wisconsin is not real high, because that's being shipped from another country.
You mentioned that there's this longstanding tension between the beer-drinking folks and the temperance folks. Can you look early on at some of the approach of churches, for example, mm-hmm. with blue laws and sort of the decision as to when you can drink in the state of Wisconsin?
Yeah. Well, that tension sure goes way back in time. And in Baraboo in the 1840s, there's this tavern rebellion that happens as the temperance people become upset by a man that had died of alcohol-related issues, leaving his widow penniless. And the women got together in the church and, with the help of their pastor getting them agitated, decided they were going to rid Baraboo of liquor for once and for all. And they rose up and took to the streets and went to about 8 of the taverns in town and just busted them up, went inside, broke all the booze bottles, took axes, and caved in all the beer barrels. And as they moved their way down the street, the men started to get alarmed and tried to put up a little protest, but the women weren't having any of them and just stormed past them. And by the time they got to the last tavern that they were going to bust up, the owner of the tavern, who was very inebriated, joined in and helped them to bust his tavern up. And they were arrested and charged with vandalism and brought to court in they'd had a change of venue, so they moved them down to Sauk Prairie, and the judge refused to throw them in jail. He recognized that there was going to be a backlash to throwing all of these women in jail, these good church-going women into jail. So,
plus, wasn't the man who died, didn't he try to murder his wife?
Yes, he did. He was a spousal abuser, which, you know, was as much a problem in the 19th century as it is today, maybe even greater, because of the people drank a lot more alcohol back then.
Yeah, it was like, if you go back to 1835 and compare present day, it's like 5-1. It's amazing that anybody could get anything done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, it was just such an accepted part of culture at that time. And I think a lot of it had to do with there were so many manual labor jobs. You know, people worked very, very hard, and to be able to do that day after day after day apparently required a little more alcohol.
Well, and probably not too many painkillers available for aching
and
all the rest
of
it. Can you say something about the restrictions on Sunday drinking?
Yeah. Well, blue laws come in the 19th century, too, and they're all part of that temperance movement. And here in Madison, there was this running battle between the political leadership of Madison that were largely Yankees and temperate, and the German population, which was the largest segment of the population. And there would be orders from on top to enforce the blue laws, and they would shut down the taverns on Sundays, and then pretty soon the back door of the tavern be cracked open on a Sunday, and you could sneak in the back, and before you know it, the front door was open again, and then there'd be a hue and cry to enforce the blue laws again, and it would start all over again. And that was just kind of a cat and mouse game that went on for much of the 1880s and 90s, at least.
What was the role of women in saloons and bars, and how did that develop over the course of time?
Well, a couple of the roles that we uncovered and talk about in the book is the first one is a little bawdy, and the women who were in the bar usually weren't looked upon in a very fine way. And there were plenty of examples of bars with brothels above or sometimes even on the main floor, sometimes very close by. So it wasn't really the cleanest story that we sometimes had to tell in there. But it's important, and it's, you know, intertwined with alcohol and how temperate folks view the evils of it and all of that. So it's in there. The other side where you see women in bars or in the back rooms with their families. So in communities with large German populations, there will be a side entrance, and it's a family space or a women's entrance. And, you know, they're able to drink there and not be there won't be men nearby who are drunk and they'll have problems with.
Mm-hmm. But they couldn't be bartenders for quite a while, right?
Oh, no. They called those ladies' parlors in the 19th century, and it's a way to accommodate, German families. The entire family drank beer. Even the kids drank beer in the 19th century. So to be able to accommodate that, they had these spaces that were closed off as separate rooms from the saloons so that the kind of moral excesses that were happening in the saloons were shielded from the eyes of women and children. And but yet they could come in as a family to enjoy some drinks together.
So are there places in Wisconsin today that are known to have been speakeasies back during Prohibition?
There are a lot of places that are have speakeasy stories. You know, whether they are true or not is awfully hard to tell sometimes because it was illegal. You know, it would be like coming back 50 years from now and trying to find the crack houses
your
community. They operated underground. But we certainly have heard many speakeasy stories as we've been traveling the states, and we have some that we know very well were speakeasies because we have the documentation
sure.
of that.
Newspaper stories, I suppose, of raids.
I'm thinking of Heine's Tavern,
yeah.
Mark.
Yeah. One of the speakeasies that we came across and really found by accident as we were cruising by on the highway, we stopped and looked at this great bar, and it didn't work its way into the book. There wasn't space. We didn't need it. But they said, you know, there's a great bar you should go see a couple miles back down a dirt road. There's a little sign out front, and you'll like it. So we followed that. And the description, just getting there, was part of its history, right? It was squirreled away off the back roads, kind of out of sight of everybody and the law enforcement agencies. And when we get in there, there's a pink and black Art Deco bar. And in the corner, there's this mirror with this striking bubble nude etching dancer on there. And that we hadn't seen that anywhere yet. You know, I've seen it in pictures and postcards from the 30s. And so we looked around and talked to the owners, and they kind of knew a little of this or a little of that. But we had to come back, and we had to get into the newspapers and do some research. And we found that the place was Alice King's Inn. And in the 30s, she was busted multiple times, both as a brothel, but also for selling illegal alcohol and liquor.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was the way we were able to discover those places, through the sources that talked about that agents would raid it, they'd padlock the place, and she'd pay $1,000 fine and then be open in a couple days.
Now, was this near a place that would have been, lumber country or farm country, or what was the draw?
It was a railroad town. The town is Minnesota Junction, and it was a place where a couple of different rail lines crossed. So it was a busy kind of place, probably with a lot of people coming from out of town there. And that's very typical of places that had brothels. They were places that were highly industrialized. Hurley's probably the most famous example
sure,
of that.
But notorious.
But all the industrial cities in Wisconsin had scores of brothels. Oshkosh, La Crosse, Eau Claire, Green Bay, they all had many brothels. And a lot of it was because there were a lot of men there who were away from their families, who were, you know, might farm in the summer and come to work in the factories in the winter, or you know, are trying to save up some money to bring their family over to join them, and you know, there are a lot of temptations.
That's true. Well, Wisconsin being so seasonal, I mean, you've got the whole shipping industry, for example, which is seasonal, and so they would be transitory.
Yeah, lots of transient workers, and where you had the highest number of transient workers, you had the highest likelihood for brothels, but they existed almost everywhere in the state.
You mentioned in your book that with Prohibition, it did have quite an impact on some of the taverns and companies. And can you talk about what the actual years were and how that affected Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, Prohibition's passed in 1919, but things are actually drying up by 1917. There was a federal law passed that was meant to try to preserve grains for feeding troops during the war that had the consequence of making it very difficult for brewers to get grain to brew. So already there's kind of a de facto prohibition happening at that point in time. The prohibition runs up till 1933 when Wisconsin legalizes beer, and then in 1934 they legalize hard liquor.
And during that stretch, were some things lost forever?
Oh, sure. Many breweries entered Prohibition and never came back out again. The larger ones were able to survive because they had a lot of capital, but the smaller breweries died. You know, there were probably somewhere around 300 breweries in Wisconsin pre-Prohibition, and 72 of them make it out of Prohibition.
Did any of them go into temporarily for the duration, those 14 years, they go into alternative beverages?
Yeah, sure. They tried whatever they could think of to stay alive. Schlitz made candy bars and bubble gum. Many of them brewed soda, near beer. One of them made cheese. I think it was Pabst that made cheese. They were trying to see whatever they could come up with to try to keep those buildings open and their people employed. But it was a huge effect on industry. In Milwaukee, brewing was the fifth largest industry in the city. So, you know, imagine taking a city as industrial as Milwaukee and closing down the fifth largest industry overnight. That has a huge, staggering economic consequence. It's like the GM plant closing in Janesville today.
So was there a lot of, instead of bathtub gin, bathtub beer being brewed?
Absolutely. One of the loopholes of Prohibition was it wasn't illegal to produce wort, which is basically the cooked mash that beer is made from. It wasn't illegal to produce that. So there were breweries that just made wort all through Prohibition, and they would bottle it up in 5-gallon jugs, and you'd get your wort and you add your yeast and let it ferment, and you had beer.
That was a legal thing to do, though?
Yeah, it was legal to do.
Legal to brew your own?
Well, it was legal for these breweries to do it because it was not alcohol.
Right.
It didn't become alcohol until you added the yeast and let it ferment.
But what would people ostensibly use this wort for if not for brewing illegal beer?
Yeah, there were arguments that it had nutritional value, that you could use it in baking and things like that. But everybody knew very well where it was going into. And the feds tried to stop it. The prohibition agents filed a suit in Milwaukee against the largest producer of wort to try to shut them down. And the district attorney refused to prosecute it, probably because he had to continue to live in Milwaukee.
Savvy guy.
What about cocktails? You talk about that in your book.
Yeah.
Where do cocktails come into the story?
Well, cocktails have a long history. They're around for a very long time. The first use of the term cocktail dates back to the 1820s or so. But they are not what you would consider a cocktail to be today. Although the one cocktail that survived from that very earliest day is the old fashioned. The old fashioned is a drink that goes back at least into the 1840s, and it was a type of cocktail called a Bitter Sling, which was basically just booze with a couple bittering agents added to it to give it some flavor and some water. And in the 20th century, during Prohibition, cocktails become different because they in the speakeasies, they have all of this terrible rot gut liquor, and they're trying to make it palatable to drink. And there's an explosion of brewing of soda during that period because many of the brewers switch to soda. Soda becomes a much, much larger thing than it was before Prohibition. So they start taking the sweet soda and mixing it with booze and then adding maraschino cherries and bitters and other things to it to try to make it more palatable. And that's really where the cocktail culture that we have today comes from.
We'll look at some of the social consequences of breweries and taverns in Wisconsin when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are Jim Drager and Mark Speltz. They're the authors of Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries. It's really interesting to look at the bars in terms of the social history that it tells, the political history and so on. You mentioned in the book that the bars, for the most part, were bastions of men. It seems, for the most part, that they're bastions of white men. Mm-hmm. Can you say something about what the history of bars and breweries tells us about ethnicity and gender in Wisconsin?
Well, certainly in terms of ethnicity, the one thing that these taverns stories tell is that if you're a minority business owner and you want to own a tavern, the deck is stacked against you because the whole power structure in a time that segregation and racism was a big part of our culture made it very difficult for these people to make a living. When we were doing research for the book, we were looking at taverns in Milwaukee, looking for African-American-owned taverns that dated back before the 1960s. And we got a list of them out of a black business directory. And not only were they not taverns anymore, the buildings weren't even there anymore. The buildings were all in places that had been leveled in urban renewal in that period. And, you know, the story that tells is how difficult it is to have owned a business like that. In Madison, when the Greenbush was being redeveloped in the 1960s, there was a African-American tavern owner and owned a bar called the Tuxedo Tavern who made application to the city to relocate his tavern onto Park Street, which a number of other taverns in that neighborhood had been able to do, and the neighborhood rose up against him and got signatures on a petition. They had a couple hundred people sign saying that it would be detrimental to the neighborhood to have this tavern move in. They never referred to race, but they talked about congestion and parking and things like that, and the city denied him. The affirmative action office in Madison had just been opened, so he made an affirmative action complaint against them, and they investigated and determined that there was no basis to the complaint, even though, you know, they let a half a dozen other taverns relocate that didn't have black owners into that neighborhood. And looking at back in from the lens of today, it seems pretty obvious it was discrimination that prevented him from relocating.
And what about the role of women?
Well, women come into the bar in earnest earliest in the speakeasies. And as they've enjoyed those tasty cocktails, they come into the new bars that are opening right after Prohibition. And we get what we know as a cocktail craze and a cocktail lounge that comes out of that. And how you see that manifest, if you walk into a bar today and you see a really intact place like the casino in La Crosse, you'll notice that there are small tables and little booths that are provide, you know, seating comfortably for two, maybe a few more, but it's a very intimate setting. So men are bringing their girlfriends and sometimes their wives into this space and enjoying the cocktails.
So it's no longer just a bar. It's a bar plus these intimate spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, during the Prohibition days, you know, there are no rules in speakeasies. There are no conventions for speakeasies. It's an illegal place to begin with. So that's right around the same era of the flapper when women are trying to draw off these Victorian shackles and live a more equitable lifestyle. So these flapper girls come into the tavern during the speakeasy days, and they never really leave. And when the taverns become legal again in 33, it has a pretty dramatic change on the way taverns are. Another thing, in addition to what Mark said, is that the bar stool comes in that period.
Oh, does it?
I think, you know, my theory is the bar stool is a concession to having women in the tavern, and you know, couples want to sit and relax and be able to converse, and it's hard when you're standing in a line along a straight bar to have a conversation. So the bar stools make it easier for people to converse, and the bar itself changes too, and you get bars that are more rounded so that you can be able to see the couple next to you and be able to converse with them.
So the rail and the spittoons are long gone.
Yeah, and I think there was probably a conscious effort to bring women into the tavern at that point too, for their moderating influence. Better behavior to try to clean up some of the excesses that existed during the saloon days. Let's bring women into the tavern, and then we won't have quite as much of a problem with that. You're not going to have prostitutes standing at the bar if you have women sitting on a bar stool next to them. So there's a conscious effort to try to change that culture. You can also see it in the beer advertising of that period as well. If you look at ads from the 1940s and 50s, it's a very common theme in the ad is a husband and wife sitting down at the in the living room enjoying a glass of beer together, or the wife pouring a glass of beer for her husband. They began to market beer. The brewers began to market beer directly to women because they realized, well, women do most of the shopping to begin with, but they also realized that if they could make women part of the process of buying beer, it was going to be a lot less likely that Prohibition was going to come back in the future.
Well, also it's a huge market too.
Sure.
Yes,
you
it's
get
a
the
giant,
women to consume.
Yes, it's a giant market. They're growing the market as well.
You talk about bars as a place of entertainment too, whether it's music or games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you go into a bar, there's drinking, but there's also jukeboxes. There's mm-hmm. live music. There's games to do. Can you talk about some of the things you've found?
Sure. Well, you know, culturally, the bar has always been what today some people call the third place. You know, there's work and there's home, and then there's that third place. And taverns, especially in Wisconsin, have been that third place. And in the 19th century, a lot of that is because people lived in small buildings. They lived in tenements, in apartments that didn't really have space to entertain in. So the tavern was the place where you entertained, where you got together with your neighbors and your friends. And, you know, when you all get together, you want to have some fun, too. So taverns were always places where people played games and had music. My favorite game from the Stagecoach days was a game called Cracky Lou, where people threw coins up in the air and let them land on the floor. And then whatever coin was closest to the crack, a crack in the floor, was the winner. And the other people had to buy them around. And there was also a version of spin the bottle that would be played where they'd spin the bottle around and then whoever it pointed at had to buy around. Music is certainly a big part of taverns from the very beginning. They had live music, and the jukebox is, you know, kind of the modern day, the 20th century replacement for that live music in many places.
When do you start to see, things like beer pong come in.
Well, beer pong is a pretty recent development. But, you know, Shake of the Day is something that is a tradition in many Wisconsin taverns and has been around for a very, very long time, where people shake dice against the bartender and try to win a free drink, or sometimes they put money into a kitty and you win the kitty.
As you were looking at these 70 bars that you selected for inclusion, were there some that really stood out architecturally where, separate from what you could buy to drink, just looking at it, either the fixtures or the way it was set up really stood out?
Typically, the bars that were associated with breweries, what we call as what are known as tide houses, they were often funded by the brewery. Those are some of the most architecturally significant and beautiful places that you visit today. If you go in and find an example of a beautiful mahogany back bar, front bar, cigar cases, bottle cases, if it's all intact, and sometimes if you can find information about where the bar's history is, that it was funded by a brewery or set up by a brewery pre-prohibition, that would be one of the finest bars you might step into.
Mm-hmm. The tide houses are called tide houses because they were tied economically to the brewery. The brewery became the owner of the tavern, and then they leased that tavern to an operator. And because the breweries had a lot more capital than your average tavern owner did, they could afford to have much more architecturally elaborate interiors. So during that tide house period, you see a lot more money being spent on the bar fixtures, and taverns become a lot more elegant and a lot more finely fitted than the earlier taverns.
Have smoking bans really had a negative impact on bar and tavern economy?
I think for us, they were very positive. The smoking ban passed in the middle of our trips to all of these taverns, and I can tell you it was a whole different kind of trip when you could walk into a tavern and not have it be completely filled with tobacco smoke.
Architecturally, I don't think we've seen many changes yet. But if you drive by taverns and start to pay attention, you'll see the little side porches. You'll see, you know, canvas roofs. In the winter, you'll hear the flapping plastic. Mm-hmm. So it's we didn't cover that from a design side. But it was just starting to take shape. Even the Tavern League's publications at that time, they were including information on how tavern owners might start to think about helping those who smoke be more comfortable outside.
So the tavern design really does reflect the society from one decade to the next.
Yeah, that's the really fascinating thing about it is there's an architectural manifestation to every period of tavern history in Wisconsin. That's what we try to show in the book, that a tavern is not just a tavern, it's a tavern, that the moment in time that created that tavern makes it look, it forces it to look a certain way. And it's a consequence of regulation of taverns, but it's also just a consequence of culture and what people believe at a particular point in time that helps shape those taverns.
You talk about how, I guess it's 1872 that you said was the peak of taverns with 4,000 in the U.S., and then how now, 75% of the alcohol is bought outside of a tavern or in Walmart and grocery stores and liquor stores and so on. And I sense a tone of nostalgia running through your book. Can you say something about that as we close?
Our nostalgia comes from, I think, understanding that if we're going to be able to tell this story and to appreciate this history, you have to have the tangible things yet that embody that history. You know, that it's one thing to read a book on Wisconsin taverns, but it's a whole nother thing to actually be able to go into one of these places and see that history live before you. And that's where our nostalgia comes from, as we recognize that these buildings are containers that hold our history and they hold these stories of the past. So all of these taverns that we include in the book, we consider to be rather precious. They are not ubiquitous. They're very rare. It's really unusual to find a tavern that is intact from almost any age that it was created. The hardest taverns actually to find were taverns that were intact from the 1970s and 1980s, because they're just so modified. people don't think at all about changing them. And so finding one from that period that's very intact, like Le Tigre Lounge here in Madison, or This Is It in Milwaukee, was a remarkable, remarkable find.
Well, thanks for guiding us through some of these bars and taverns in Wisconsin history and culture along the way, Jim Draeger and Mark Speltz.
Sure. If you want to pick up a copy of the book and put it in your glove box, you can guide yourself.
Just be sure to read responsibly.
Read responsibly. Do not read while driving. That's right. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.